Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to Giving Up the Ghost Cast with me, Shannon Kyle.
And me, Tina Lyons.
Tina and I are two real-life, multiple best-selling ghostwriters who would like to lift the veil on the publishing industry's best-kept secret, the world of ghostwriting.
Well, you've probably never heard of us. There's a very good chance you've read our words.
So who are ghostwriters? How does ghostwriting work? And how do most bestsellers get written?
I'm so glad you are, Shannon. Let's listen to Giving Up the Ghost Cast to find out. Hello and welcome to today's episode of Giving Up the Ghost Cast. In today's show, we'll be talking to renowned ghostwriter Ian Shercor, who's been in the business for 40 plus years.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to talking to Ian later. That's going to be great. But before that, we have some things to chat about what's happening in the world of ghostwriting. So what have you got today?
Well, I picked up this week a piece in Modern Diplomacy, which is an online platform looking at international issues. And I was very excited to see this week that they've done a piece on ghostwriting.
Oh, wow.
Ethical authorship and legal considerations.
Oh, my goodness.
It's really interesting to see these things out in the mainstream, in inverted commas, because you just don't normally see it. Yeah, very interesting, talking about authorship considerations, i.e. that we should decide up front whether or not we get any credit or acknowledgement. Always nice to have with Tina Lyons or with Shannon Kyle on the front, any authors listening, in case you want to go for that. But also the legal considerations. So obviously there's the normal stuff you'd see any business contract about deadlines, goals, milestones, all that sort of stuff. But then copyright, which as a ghost is something that we're always very conscious of, because for those that don't know copyright law, if you're both involved with writing a book, you by law have 50% of the copyright each. And it's practice for ghosts to assign their copyright to the author so they can do with their book as they wish. But again, it's not something that you hear talked about at all.
I think a lot of ghostwriters have to end up relying on publishers or their agents to sort this out. I know that the British Society of Authors run an amazing service where they will look over any contracts. In fact, they've got a whole team of people doing it, and they'll do it for free. I mean, as long as you're a member of the society. I've used them several times, actually, just to kind of have a look at over the contracts that I've used. I've got a template myself, and you know, I tend to use a standard contract for most of the work. But I mean, a lot of us aren't legal bods.
No,
we don't know,
absolutely, and we
have to kind of rely on other people to help us. So it is good to see a bit of discussion about it.
Yeah, brilliant. And as I say, nice to spot it being chatted about in the open.
Today's guest is Ian Shercor. He's a ghostwriter and author with over 40 years' experience. He describes himself as someone who's been a paid poet, pundit, and punster. He's written a dozen books in his own right, including the best-selling Conspiracy, The Greatest Cover-Ups and Unsolved Mysteries. And he's also the author of So Brightly at Last, an offbeat poetic biography examining the poetry, or the very little-known poetry, of Clive James. Welcome to Giving Up the Ghost Cast, Ian. Nobody grows up as a child thinking, I'd like to become a ghostwriter. So what was the start of your journey?
By the time it actually even occurred to me, or the situation arose where I was able to have a first swing at it, I'd written 8, 9, 10 books of my own, and they had made me very confident and proud of being an author and fairly impoverished. I think by that stage, I worked out I'd earned in total about £14,000 or £15,000 from all the books put together, and I like to eat occasionally, so that was a very good deal. And suddenly someone, I can't remember, through some business contact, somebody said, what do you know about marketing analytics, detailed big data marketing analytics? And I said, 9/10 of nothing, really, why are you asking? And they put me in touch with this guy who wanted to do a book, who was brilliant, I mean, just the ideal author to work with in that context, because he knew exactly what he wanted to say. I would say to him each week, remember, I know nothing about your subject. I'm going to come in next week. We'll have a 50-minute interview slot, only 50 minutes, because I can't keep my concentration much longer than that. Can you prepare for it? And he'd go, yeah, I'll make some notes and I'll prepare for it. And each week I'd come in, I did 16 interviews with him. Each week I'd come in and he would talk for 50 minutes. At the end of 50 minutes, he'd go, well, that's everything I've got on my list. Is there anything else we should be talking about? It's just wonderful. Very clever, very cool, rather cold, but very logical man. And just the perfect person to start off with. After which I thought, oh, I can work with anybody. And then real life started.
And did you get an agent following that? I mean, how did the process work?
I know you work well with agents. My experience with agents of any sort over the years has been disastrous. I've been signed to, I think they claim to be London's fifth or sixth biggest literary agency for 10 years now, and I've never got anything worth having out of them at all, either to do with my own books or ghosting books. So no, they've always been things that have come through friends of friends, somebody lined up a project and then couldn't do it. Business people have talked to business people and said, oh, I know somebody who's broadly sane and fairly glib and articulate who could probably help you with this. No, agents and indeed publishers have hardly come into it. I did one ghosting job for a publisher, but that's all. Do we want the story about that?
We do, absolutely.
The story about that is very interesting because, as you know, one of the keys to what we do is getting the voice right. And that book was the only book I'd ever done with someone with a, other than non-English speakers, but an English person, a Londoner, with a totally different idiolect, as they call them, a totally different vocabulary and tone of voice and accent from anything I'd handled before. And the story about it is that both you and I ended up in a period of a few years writing basically the same book for Paul Connolly, who a man who had a very interesting backstory because he'd been brought up in a council children's home that'd been infiltrated by a brutal paedophile gang. And it's a great story. And there were lots of things about it that I couldn't get into my version of his story. And your version had different bits of it. And I mean, it was hilarious. I had no idea you were doing that. When it came out, I thought, ah, she's written the same book as me. Neither of us talk like that man talks, you know, with his life on the fringes of London's gangster underworld and things, and wonderful quotes. I don't know, can't remember if you had the quote or I did, but quotes like, oh, you know, there's a huge difference between being slashed with a Stanley knife and plunged with a sharpened screwdriver. You think, oh, this is aspects of life I haven't come across before.
So just to recap then, how did you come across that book? So, I mean, just so listeners understand, Ian wrote a book for Paul Connolly and it was called Against All Odds. And I believe, was it Blake who published that for you?
Yeah, John Blake.
That's it. And it became an absolutely massive bestseller, didn't it? I mean, it did extremely well. So can you just tell us a bit about how you got that job?
Very simple. I mean, I had published a book on conspiracies with John Blake a year or two before in my own right, proper grown-up book in my own right. And someone at John Blake obviously thought, oh, here's the ideal match for this East End guy with his rough and ready ways, and put me, the 21st century's version of Kenneth Moore, to try and capture Paul Connolly's voice. I mean, for me, it was a technical triumph. I remember at the end being over at Paul's house, talking to his wife, and she said, oh, you know, it's great. I read the book. It's really nice. And I just can't tell what bits are you and what bits are Paul. And I thought, yes, I can do this.
That's what you want, isn't it? When you have the friends and family make that comment, you just go, you got it right. Yeah, I mean, I sort of came into the project quite late because Paul's team were going to write a script based on his story. But there were elements of the story that they wanted to include that hadn't been included in the first book. And so he wanted to retell the story. And indeed, I think there were parts of the story that he wasn't allowed or encouraged to write about with the publisher. So he just decided to rewrite this book essentially, which is the same story but with more detail. And in fact, some of the detail was really quite horrific of what happened in that children's home. And then the book, it was called Not Normal when I did it, and then they changed the name to Big Boys Don't Cry because the film version was called Big Boys Don't Cry, the script version. And that film was shown on Netflix, and it actually became, I think it got to number 3 in the UK film chart. It did incredibly well. I mean, very hard-hitting film. The story was about how Paul had survived in this children's home and subsequently grew up with, you know, all kinds of difficulties, and actually managed to track down one of the perpetrators of the children's home. You know, I won't give the ending away, but it really was a very hard-hitting story. But also, you know, I mean, just because you have done an incredibly diverse range of books, you know, from business books, management books, and then you've had a long-standing relationship with Clive James as well. Could you just sort of tell us a bit about how you met Clive and how that relationship developed into you essentially writing his final poetic biography?
Well, that really does go back a long way, because I'm the same age as your grandparents. I actually met Clive in a folk club I was running in Richmond in 1968-69. That was funny in itself. Clive wasn't very famous then. He was about 28, I think, 29 something. He was doing a bit of journalism, tiny bit of television, I think. No one knew him. I didn't know him. And he turned up there with Pete Atkin, a singer and songwriter who Clive wrote 200 songs with over 50 years. So they were a writing partnership. But when they turned up at my club, there was this tall, obviously intelligent, well-spoken English Cambridge guy, Pete Atkin, who was the performer and the musical genius in the pairing. But I didn't know they were pairing. All I could see was Pete with his guitar and then this sort of bull-necked Australian bouncer who he'd brought along with him. And I thought, well, blimey, he's not famous enough to need to bring his own security, is he? And then I found that this bloke whose neck was wider than his head turned out to be Clive James, an incredibly bright, funny, multi-talented guy. So I knew them for 5 or 6 years in the 70s and then didn't see either of them again until, I don't know, 2015 or something, when I went to a gig of Pete's and talked to him backstage and said, who's done a book on your songs with Clive? Because everybody would be interested in those. And he said, no one. So we talked to Clive and said, would you be keen on that? And then I wrote a book called Loose Cannon, The Extraordinary Songs of Clive James and Pete Atkin. And that sold a bit. There were still some people who weren't dead yet who remembered them from the 70s. And there were some new people who discovered these chilling, hilarious, very, very varied songs that they'd written. And then after I'd done the songs book, I was sitting around at Clive's place in Cambridge. He'd been ill. He'd been at death's door at that stage for 5 or 6 years, but he wasn't actually keeling over. So I thought I'd push my luck. And I said, somebody ought to do a book about your poetry. And he said, yeah, they should. And I said, has anybody approached you about it? And he said, yeah, every year about 10 or 12 people get in touch and they want to do academic books about my poetry. And I'm simply not interested in that. But I would be interested in someone doing a down-to-earth non-academic book about what's fun and sad and interesting about the poems. Why don't you do it? And I said, well, because I haven't read any poems since I left York University in 1972, except for a couple of yours. He said, oh, that's a good start. You know, read some and read mine and let's talk about it. And so I went up and did lots of interviews in Cambridge with him as he gradually got worse and worse with the 3 or 4 life-threatening conditions that he had. And I got the book finished and read by him. He read it twice and was delighted with it. And it actually got published in the week that Clive died. And it's called So Brightly at the Last, Clive James and the Passion for Poetry. That spun off from a chance meeting in 1969, but it took a long time to spin.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been quite an emotional experience, actually, particularly when someone is essentially dying, like, and you're writing their book. I mean, do you think that informed what you were trying to do in any way? Was there sort of this emotional, I mean, obviously there must have been a sense of, we've got to get this done, time limit on it.
The word deadline had never had any particular significance for me, but it suddenly did. Yeah,
it was. Yeah,
I'm not a fast worker. I know you do 7 books a year and still have time to look after your family and things like that. But I'm not a fast worker, and I got faster and faster as Clive got iller and iller, because I was desperate, basically, to have his approval for it. I wanted him to love it and his family to love it. And it became obvious that it would be sort of a legacy thing, because nobody'd ever written. There are no books, even now, apart from my two, there are no books about Clive James other than the 40 or so about Clive James, broadly speaking, written by Clive. Nobody's done another biography.
Why do you think that is? Because he is a huge star.
I mean, you're well informed about everything under the sun, but I think maybe it's an age thing. You know, most of the people who are aware of Clive, or who are aware of him as anything other than a face on the television in the 90s, really, have died off. Rude as that. You know, the Radio 4 producers are always talking about, we need to get the replenishment audience sorted out. We need to go for younger people because everybody dies on us and we lose audience that way. I think it's pretty much that.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Having feet in both camps, as it were, of writing your own work and ghosting, do you have any preferences for either or? I mean, they're very different disciplines and very different muscles, aren't they? You know, disappearing into someone else's life, is there some sort of relief around that?
Yes, absolutely. You wouldn't necessarily expect it, but there are a lot of times when I'd rather be sitting here at 1 o'clock in the morning, because I work very late. I work long days. I don't work many days, but I work long days. So if I'm really digging into something, I'll start at 9:30 in the morning and finish at 1:30 or 2:00 at night. And there is something I really enjoy about, I don't know, the carpentry, the craftsmanship, just the exercise of a set of skills that I've developed over decades without having to take that ultimate responsibility for, is this absolutely right? Is this the best I can possibly do? Is this what I want heaped up on my gravestone afterwards? You can go, no, it's somebody else's book and I'm doing a very good job for them, and I'm sure they don't appreciate the finesse of this paragraph that was just rewritten 3 times, but I suppose in a sense I'm doing it for me. And also, of course, every time you're ghosting, you're earning a living. And when you're not ghosting, in my experience, you're not earning a living. I had a new book on conspiracies out last year, which has sold 32,000-33,000 copies. And when I saw the royalty check for that, I mean, it's lovely to have big sales like that. And I've actually seen a couple of people wandering around in the wild carrying copies of it. But when I saw the royalties check for that, I thought, well, from an earning point of view, a paying the bills point of view, it wasn't worth doing.
I mean, that's a real misnomer, isn't it? That I think a lot of people don't understand about royalties, that they're just barely worthwhile almost all the time.
It's the word. We shouldn't let them be associated with anything to do with royalness. They're sort of scrapings off the bottom of the barrel. You know this, a 20 quid book, if it's going to sell a lot, it's going to sell a lot through the heavily discounted retail outlets. Mm. So through Waterstones, Smiths, particularly WH Smith Travel, perhaps, and through Amazon. And all those people outside the business don't know, all those outlets take 55% or so as their cut. When that happens, you get onto paragraph 8B in your contract, which is the one for heavily discounted sales, however, will be on some minuscule royalty. And you look at it and you think, I'm getting 32 pence per copy for a book that's notionally a 20 quid book or something like that.
I know. And I think, I mean, I don't know about you, but I get a lot of potential clients contact me and they say, I don't have a budget, but you can take a cut of the royalties, as if they're doing me a really big favour. And you just have to kind of say, look, actually, it's just kind of not how it works, because absolutely nobody understands how it works.
I mean, if they're good humoured people, I say things like, so what cut are you suggesting? I mean, if I had, say, 110% of your royalties, you know, that'd be 110% of basically nothing.
I know. It's just one of the many myths around the publishers and publishing and how it all works.
Yeah, it's true.
There was a book that you've recently worked on. It was the high jumper that I've been praying to, because that was a very long project.
Athlete. It's yes. still going. I've just sent off the manuscript after 3 years. We've had COVID, we've had 2 world championships and an Olympic Games, and COVID going on and everything like that. So it's the slowest book that's ever been ghostwritten, I think. The guy's got a fantastic story. I knew nothing about track and field before. It didn't relate to things like marketing analytics or digitalization in small manufacturing companies or, you know, anything that I'd ghosted before. But it's been a fantastic project. I was thinking about it the other day and thinking, when I get to the end of that and it works out that I've made no money at all on it, I should be quite happy, because I'm proud to have given him a good book and he deserves it. It's a lovely bloke.
3 years is an incredibly long time. And do you find that keeping up that momentum can be quite hard, you know, if you goes for yes. months and months between interviews?
Yes. When I'm not working, I like to play tennis. I only discovered tennis about 6 or 7 years ago, and I'm really bad at it, but I love doing it 2, 3, 4 times a week, playing doubles. And tennis teaches you about life. Actually, it teaches you lots about life, like generally you're going to lose and all sorts of things like that. But one of the things that's been professionally useful from that is the idea that the key thing is to get the ball back across the net. When I've got long running things like that, where there are holdups and things sag, or people are ill, or they're distracted by a takeover of their business or something like that, I'm always thinking, okay, I'm prepared to let this slide for a few weeks, but I don't want letting it slide to be my fault. So after a while, I pop the ball back over the net. I send them an email which sort of says, oh God, I'm so enthusiastic and raring to go to get on. Let's get your book finished and out in the shops and things. And you can hold it in your hand and you could smell the glory of a freshly printed book. You know, can I come and see you the week after next or something like that? And then usually you get something back saying, actually, it's all my fault. Yes, come on, let's get on with it. You know, I've usually got 3 or 4 projects at various stages of cooking at different times. And the idea, I've just done a round of it in the last week or so, writing the emails so that in each case, I've popped the ball over the net and it's in their court. You know, if anything goes wrong, it's their fault.
Yeah, that's a really great way of looking at it, actually. And it's a great analogy. At the end of every interview, we ask the same 3 questions to all of the ghosts that we're talking to. So the first one is, on your fantasy bookshelf, which books have you ghosted?
Adventures in the Screen Trade by William Goldman. I've only ever seen, I think, 30 or 40 films in my life. I've seen fewer films than anybody else. And most of those I saw when I was a kid in short trousers. They're all the same film, basically. They were Battle of the River Plate and Sink the Bismarck and everything. And I grew up thinking that I would spend my adult life on the bridge of a warship, wearing a duffel coat with binoculars to my eyes, going, destroyer 4,000 yards port bow, sir, shall we engage? But it didn't turn out like that. So life's been a letdown, really. But
you still get to play tennis, though, Ian.
Yeah, but the William Goldman book, I think, is just superb, even though half of the film references I just don't understand, but I think it's wonderfully witty, clever, super book.
So question number 2 is, what's your biggest secret that you can tell us?
Secret.
It's a bit of a trigger word we've discovered. If we say the word secret around a ghostwriter, we all panic.
Yeah. Is there... Well, okay. I got that. You got the panic. All right. Okay. Last year, I had to get the new conspiracy book that was a bestseller last year done in, I refused to do it. And then they gave me an impossible deadline and I rose to the challenge because I couldn't resist it. And I used a ghostwriter.
Amazing.
In fairness, in my own defense, I'd point out I used a ghostwriter for, I think, 3, 3.5, 4 chapters. Just things where I very much wanted to do stuff about, well, for example, the first chapter about the sub-postmaster's UK sub-postmaster's post office scandal. And whilst I was as furious as everybody else in the world about some of the things Donald Trump had done as president and things like that, I didn't know a lot about the American stuff. And there's an Australian writer who I know, brilliant writer, called David Free, who never gets the work and the acknowledgement he deserves. And he had written a book, I think, for Yale about conspiracies, which they commissioned and then decided they didn't want to publish because it was too normal and not academic enough. And so I got in touch with David and said, listen, I've got to do this really, really quickly. Would you be interested? And the thing is, working with somebody in Australia, while you sleep, your book is creeping forward. And
that's brilliant.
I'd wake up in the morning, I'd ring David and he'd go, oh, mate, I'm so tired. I go, good, good. What have you been doing? How has my book come on today? So my secret is that I used a ghostwriter. It was interesting to see it from the other side, of course. Useful.
Yeah, I bet that was. And what was the deadline out of interest? How tight was that?
Well, we arranged in early February that I'd do it. And they didn't actually need the manuscript, the final manuscript, till the 1st of April.
Oh, my goodness. That is tight. That is, yeah. And the final question, Ian, is what's the title for the book about your life?
The title is Chatbotting, because what I do is assemble a lot of disparate bits of information from different angles and different sources and different places. Unlike chatbots, of course, I do actually check the veracity of what I'm picking up, but then slam it all together into some plausible set of words. So chatbotting, maybe.
Yeah, love it. I mean, that's very now as well with the whole AI, etc. And you know, where does AI start and where do we finish? I mean, I love it. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Ian, for joining us. I really appreciate your time. Right. Brilliant talking to you.
Nice to see you.
It was fantastic to hear Ian talking. I mean, funnily enough, I bought the conspiracy book for my teenage son, who's a massive conspiracy theorist and adores it. And he loved the book. In fact, he quoted it to me like every day whilst he was reading it. He kept it by his bedside table. So I feel I know the book very well, although I personally haven't read it, but I shall do now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Ian's one of those people that he's just so kind of modest about his incredible talents and achievements. A mix of books and the range over the years that he's done, like he says, you know, you can pull the story out and sound so much like the authors. I mean, I think there's a quote on his website where the author actually says, you sound more like me than I sound like me. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. And I love the idea of a ghostwriter using a ghostwriter. It's like sort of a mirror image, isn't it? It could go on forever.
Exactly.
Unbox them.
Well, for a deadline like that, I mean, I think lots of ghostwriters would like to use a ghostwriter. Maybe that's something we should start doing.
We could all start helping each other out. The whole new business.
Now it's time for our regular segment, Digging Up the Ghost Past, where we look at some sort of historical ghost-written book, etc. But you've got something a little bit different this week, Tina, haven't you?
Yeah, I had a look this week at famous authors who also ghostwrite, which is quite interesting. So one of the ones that really made me notice, Hilary Mantel, who's obviously very famous, sadly no longer with us, famous for Wolf Hall and Bringing Up the Bodies, but she also ghosted memoirs as well. She did a British politician and a Saudi princess. So this set me off on a bit of a sort of detective mission to see who else. So Ian Fleming, who we know from James Bond, before he was a successful author, he ghosted various sort of travel guides and articles. There's been speculation about Stephen King, who's never publicly admitted ghostwriting, but he's believed to have written under other names.
Wow. Oh, that's fascinating.
Well. Yeah. And Tom Clancy has also written some books in the Harlequin Romance series.
Oh, my goodness. It's like people's alter egos coming out here.
Yeah, they sort of thought, I don't want to write thrillers anymore. I'm going to write about, you know, love. So it's very interesting. You think that, you know, you're either one or the other, but a lot of people tend to cross the divide.
I'd love to know the motivations behind it. Is it because they fancy just doing something completely different, or do they need the money, or, you know?
Well, I'm sure authors of this caliber don't need the money.
No.
But it is interesting. I wonder what the motivation is.
Yeah.
That's all we've got time for this week. Our thanks to Ian for joining us today, and as always, thanks to you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye for now.
Giving Up the Ghost Cast is produced by Amanda Redman and brought to you by the Ghostwriters Agency.
Thanks so much for joining us. Please remember to rate and review us on your listening app. It helps us to get noticed in the noisy world of podcasts.
Yes, it does. And if you want to get in touch, you can do so by going to theghostwritersagency.com
or following us on Twitter at GW Agency Ghosts.
See you next time. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.